morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at KSFR. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the program any time of day. You can also find us in iTunes. All of this is made possible by DotFoil Computer Services right here in Santa Fe on the web at dotfoil.com. Later on, toward the end of the program, we're going to be speaking about the Yom HaShoah Holocaust Remembrance Event, which is at the Center for Contemporary Arts this weekend. Right now, I'd like to welcome Sam Quiñones. He's a journalist with the Los Angeles Times, and he's the author of the book Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream, True Tales of Mexican Migration, published by UNM Press. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you. I really enjoyed reading this book. It's a wonderful combination of in-depth reporting and just terrific storytelling.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it's definitely worth reading, ladies and gentlemen. But it's framed by the story of Delfino Juarez, who is
right.
from the village of Xocotla, Veracruz.
Right.
Tell us his story and how you came to know him.
I really came to know him because I've done many, many, when I lived in Mexico for 10 years, I was a freelance writer then, I did many stories on immigration to the United States, but when I lived in Mexico City, I was based in Mexico City, and there I noticed that Mexico City really depended for its hardest work on lots of kids, cheap labor essentially. Kids would come in from the outlying villages. Villages from Veracruz, Puebla, the states of Veracruz, Puebla, Morelos, Hidalgo, and Oaxaca, places like that. And so what I really wanted to do was do a story about, you know, Mexico's cheap labor needs, the same way that United States has. And so I began, I found myself one day in the Alameda Park in downtown Mexico City, where all these kids go to recreate, entertainment themselves on the one day they have available to them because they work a six-day week, and that is Sundays. And there's lots of dance halls all around the Alameda now. Some are actually in parking lots and stuff to keep it cheap. And they all are geared to these kids who are all village kids, rural kids, all in the big city working for their families, essentially, and sending money back home to the villages where they're from, and their families live on that. Delfino was one of those guys. And so initially I wanted to do a story about he's a construction worker. All the guys who come from the villages normally they get jobs in the construction industry in Mexico City. And so I just wanted to tell the story of one kid in the big city, you know, and the Mexico's Mexicans kind of story. As it turned out, we got to know each other, liked him quite a bit, very nice guy. I visited his village several times, and he never spoke of going to the United States. But in the meanwhile, he got married and had a kid, and he'd bet his entire future up to that point on Mexico City. He'd been working there since age 12 in the construction industry, and he'd not really achieved much, and now he had a child and a wife, and so he decided to come to the United States. He crossed over through the Tohono O'odham Indian Reservation in Arizona, and a harrowing tale that I also tell in the book. And he comes to Los Angeles. And there he gets a job as a floorer, and in that job, what he does is he's the first one really from his village to come to the United States and make money and send it home and build himself a house. Up to that point, his family had a shack that leaked, it was terribly cold. I'd been in it several times. It's terribly cold when the wind blew. The rain leaked through. And so what he wanted was a symbol of what he could achieve in life, I think. This is what he was really after, was to kind of show people, leaving town the poorest of the poor, going to the United States, that he was, you know, kind of validating himself in a sense and providing something extremely useful and necessary for his family. So now he has a two-story house built by the dollars that he earned near Los Angeles. And the other thing that's interesting about Delfino is this is the kind of guy that I focused on him because he's, I think, kind of the quintessential immigrant. And he's this kid. He doesn't have much education. He isn't very sophisticated. But, you know, he has all this drive and energy and desire. And this was what he was unable to channel in Mexico. And that's why he came north. And he's kind of like the quintessential immigrant in that sense. I think what happens oftentimes in the immigrant process is that the United States attracts the folks who are most desirous of change, the kind of the risk takers in any given village, and that would certainly describe Delfino. And after his house went up, people knew how poor his family was in the village. They saw that in 2 years he built a beautiful house with all the amenities of a toilet, plumbing, a kitchen, the whole thing. After that, 100 guys, today I believe there's about 100, 120 guys from that village working in some part or another of the United States, all looking for that same thing that he achieved.
Delfino is such an interesting character. He's got so much chutzpah and so much creativity and boldness, right, and resourcefulness and courage, right, and just strength of will. He left his village at age 12,
right,
with a small loan from a loan shark. He didn't even tell his mother. She found, right, this out. She let him go. And before he went to the United States, he, among other things, became a break dancer.
Right. When I met him, as I said, there was this large scene. And the Alameda on Sundays, if you ever get down there, any of your listeners get down there, it's something to see on Sundays, because it becomes a kind of open-air single scene for rural kids from the villages of Veracruz, of Puebla, Oaxaca, and different places who are in the city all alone looking for an adolescence while they work 6 days a week and support their families back in those villages. So they all go to, there's thousands of kids who come to the Alameda. At least the last time I was there, this is what was going on. It was a huge thing. And in one of the dance halls, the cheapest dance hall, which I found to be the most kind of civilized in a sense. The others were just jam-packed and very difficult to maneuver through. He was one of those who started the latest fad, the latest rage, which was breakdancing. He and a couple of friends in a corner of the dance hall began just kind of experimenting with some moves, trying them out that they'd seen on TV, some kids in New York or something like that. He begins to do this. Other kids begin to watch. And so it becomes this little scene emerges where every Sunday, when they begin playing funk music and stuff, they will start this little break dancing. Well, pretty soon, construction workers, these kid construction workers in Mexico City, they don't have houses. They live in the construction sites where they work, and then when they're done, they move on to the next job. Well, at construction sites across Mexico City, after a while, all these kids began practicing at night after work. They do their back flips and their twists and their cartwheels and all this kind of amazing breakdance stuff. And by the time I came upon it, it was really quite a developed scene of construction, rural kid construction worker breakdancers every Sunday, two or three times during a Sunday afternoon. They'd form these big, large circles, and all these guys would get in, and they clearly were quite expert by the time I came upon them. They'd do backflips and cartwheels and helicopter moves and the whole bit. But to my mind, breakdancing and immigration, there's a lot of similarities between them. I mean, both require you to kind of jump out into the unknown. Both require you to use your chutzpah, your verve, your desire kind of to do something different. And that's kind of the way I focused on Delfino. He struck me as a very different kid. A lot of the other kids were very, very painfully shy around me because I'm tall and I'm white and they're not. They're very short and dark skin and they come from a very different world from mine. I think because he had left home at 12, I think because he had done this all on his own and been a very kind of a leader among his peer group, he looked at me straight in the eye. He's a short kid, but looked at me straight in the eye, spoke very politely, but not deferentially, too deferentially to me. And the other thing was that when I made an appointment with him to talk about his life, he actually kept the appointment, which I was really, really not expecting. I just expected most kids to just kind of not do it. But to my mind, he was a different kind of kid, and that's why I focused on him, because I felt that I could sense this kind of like a different way about him, a more of a confident way about him.
We're talking to Sam Quiñones, and by the way, his website is samquiñones.com, and the book is called Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream, True Tales of Mexican Migration. The story of Delfino is emblematic of a lot of stories of villages in Mexico,
right,
that lose people to the United States.
Right.
One thing is, and it's a very mixed blessing for these villages, because a lot of money comes into them. On the other hand, they lose not only a lot of their brightest and best young people, especially young men, they also lose any belief in education as a way forward.
Right. I think what has happened in Mexico is, particularly in those areas where people have been immigrating for a long time, 20, 30, 40 years, and there are many, many villages like this, by the way, particularly in the central part of north of Delfino's state, like Veracruz, more in Michoacán, Zacatecas, Guanajuato, Jalisco, places like that, where people have been emigrating for a long, long time. Mexico has really not changed the fundamentals of the reasons why they left in the first place have not changed. What they do is they come home a lot. They come home an awful lot, and there's a huge return, particularly around Christmas. And when they do, I mean, it's very common, very normal, I would say even, to come home. You want to come home and show what you've done. So they come home in beautiful cars, beautiful clothes. They also come home, every time they come home, they add to the houses. And the houses, again, is a principal theme of this book, how immigrants kind of show why they left through their houses. They want protection. They want a sign of status of what they've been able to accomplish. They build these houses, and now you get across, so you've got across Mexico, a total urban renewal of the villages across, certainly across central Mexico and north central Mexico, where these houses are just huge now and glorious and beautiful marble floors and wrought iron and beautiful, just beautiful houses. The kids grow up who grow up in the village see this, and it becomes very, very clear that they're really the people who are doing this have third grade education. They know these people. They know that they don't have much education, and they understand, well, if I go to the United States, I don't need an education. And I've spoken to many teachers in immigrant villages, and they all it's as if they're saying the exact same thing, all of them. That we're just a daycare center. We're caring for these kids till they hit 15 years old, and they are gone. They know they can work in a factory in El Monte near L.A. or in Dallas or someplace, and what they can do with that job or parlay it into something else, they don't need to be educated. And it's one of the really harmful effects, I think, of this culture of departure. So it's no longer really economics that's pushing these kids on. These kids oftentimes have money coming in from the States. They're not starving to death. Like, they're not in the serious strait that Delfino found himself in. It's more of a kind of a culture of departure where they don't want to be the only kid in town who hasn't gone north, who doesn't have his own stories, his own adventures to tell later. And this is all part of the culture of departure that I describe in the book that has now permeated all of, I would say, most of north-central Mexico, and once it starts, it's very hard to stop it. It's not like you can make economic changes and it'll stop almost immediately. It's really a cultural thing now.
There's so much to talk about with this, and one of the things that I found really shocking, because the story of Delfino is spread out throughout the book. It's at the beginning, middle, and end of the book.
Right.
One of the reasons Delfino leaves his village in the first place is that his father is just an incurable, raging alcoholic and doesn't do anything for the family.
Right.
And in the last part of the book, Delfino's father actually goes to the United States.
Right.
He's stopped drinking, and he does something productive. And Delfino himself actually had been rather into drugs and other controlled substances.
Right.
And he also is completely clean and incredibly hardworking. I mean, there's something about this move north that really cleans people's act
up. Exactly. And I was in a class the other day, and there was a religion class about the border, and they were looking for religious themes in the immigration story, you know. And my point was, look, it's rebirth. This is what happens when you're in a village where everything is constrained. If you are not part of the town elite, meaning you're not the family that owns a Coca-Cola distributorship or the mayor or something like this, then you really have so little available to you. And you either kind of submit to that, say, okay, this is just my lot in life, and you stay and you just deal with it for the rest of your life, or you move somewhere else. And one place, the migration story is one of is really a story of rebirth, giving birth to someone else, to seeing what your potential is. Is it a brutal lifestyle? Yes. And crossing the border is now an extremely hazardous and brutal thing to do. On the other hand, when people do it, I can tell you, it fills them with confidence. I saw Delfino after he crossed, you know. He was like, yeah, I did that. It's done. It's done. You know, it's not a tough thing. Obviously, people die. I'm not making light of this in the least, but there is a kind of a rebirth that takes place among many, many immigrants. It's the great, beautiful, kind of exhilarating story that I saw over and over and over again in my travels, both in Mexico and then in the United States through immigrant communities. And so that, to me, is really a kind of another theme of the book, that that people are leaving this kind of old world with all the constraints and the submission to the local power elite and so on, for a kind of a new place, a new roll of the dice, a new a fairer deal, you might say. And that's what I love about the migration story itself.
We're talking to Sam Quiñones. I mean, my mother and my grandparents on my father's side were immigrants, and yours were too. And
right.
Many of us have a story like that from, you know, Spain or Italy or other parts of Europe. This Mexican migration is a very different story in a lot of ways.
Yes.
There's no Atlantic Ocean. The border is porous. People travel both ways.
Right.
And so there's a kind of different attitude toward assimilation. Tell us more about that.
Well, I think that it kind of impedes assimilation because people, first of all, people don't go with the idea that they're going to stay. I haven't met anybody so far who went to the United States thinking, this is where I'm going to stay for the rest of my life. Everybody has this idea, I'm going home. And that is why Mexico is filling with tens and hundreds of thousands of houses, because people are coming to the United States to earn money, to build their home back in their home village in Mexico. And then someday, their idea is, someday I'm going to retire to that. You know, maybe when I'm 40, 50, 60, whenever I have the wherewithal to do so. So their thoughts, one of the other stories in the book is about a village in Zacatecas called Atolinga, where I talk about a guy who, Chon Salinas, a friend of mine now, who spent his entire life thinking that, and gave up an awful lot, he came to realize later, because he didn't put the energy or he didn't invest himself as much as he should have, he felt later on, in this country, and why you came in the first place is to get away from some of the things that you were afflicting you back in Mexico. And so assimilation takes place. It's not that it doesn't take place. It just takes place a whole lot more slowly. English language is picked up more slowly, I think, oftentimes. People aren't as tuned into what it is about America that attracted them, I think, in the first place. A lot of people are, but there's a lot of people who really don't quite get it as clearly. The interesting thing, though, is that over a course of a lifetime, and again, I go back to the houses. The houses show a whole lot about Mexican immigration. If you study immigrant houses, you can really understand a lot of the essence of Mexican immigration, I think. One of the things that's happening is after, say, 30 years or 40 years of being in the United States and building their houses and making sure they're almost like jewels, they're beautiful things, the central point of an immigrant's life sometimes is to build that house and to make sure that it's ready for him. By the time he's finished, he realizes that he really can't go home. He's too assimilated in the United States, unbeknownst to himself, really. He can't really go home again. And this is the other bizarre thing about the houses of immigrant Mexico, is that they are now all standing empty.
And as you say, you have houses that are grain storage places and jacuzzis that are filled with corn cobs.
Right, and many, many houses that are simply abandoned. I was in Jalisco a while back last year, and I took a cab ride, and I asked the cabbie to show me in the village how many of the houses had been literally abandoned. Say he hadn't seen the owners in 3 to 5 years, say. And this is a village that is fully built up with very nice houses, some more rustic than others, but very nice houses in general, certainly very livable houses, no doubt. And I think a quarter of the houses in town were abandoned. I spoke with recently with an immigration scholar in the state of Zacatecas, who told me that he's predicting that if things don't change, fully a third of Mexico will be depopulated within about 25 years. And I think, frankly, that's a long estimate. I think that's kind of already happening right now. I've visited many villages where, you know, the main village that I talk about in the introduction to the story is a village, Jaripo, Michoacan, where when I visited it 10 years ago, there were 200 kids in the school and 9 teachers. And when I visited the last time in 2004, there were 60 kids in the school and four teachers, and very few. And the parties were, you know, the fiesta, the annual fiesta, was ending at midnight instead of at 3 a.m. every night, and so on. So I think that that's really happening. And again, I get back to the houses of Mexico of immigrant Mexico that really tell the essential story of what's going on here. The people are forsaking this country that they always thought they would go back to. And I think the reason is that Mexico simply has not changed sufficiently to be a place that they want to come back to. That's really the fundamental point.
We're talking to Sam Quiñones. The book is called Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream, True Tales of Mexican Migration, published by University of New Mexico Press. I think it's really important to talk about the fact that Mexico is not a poor country devoid of resources, but rather there's a real old-world paternal structure, class structure, and a very corrupt political culture. And that's part of what's creating this migration.
Yes, I think so. In fact, that's another kind of theme that I touch on in the book, which is that Mexico never was really the New World. It was just the Old World transplanted and fit very well. The Aztec culture, frankly, I think, and the and Spanish culture and the Catholic Church fit very well together. They were both kind of hierarchical, not a lot of social mobility, not a lot of reverence for power and pomp and privilege and so on. And so I think that's really what that's the kind of the themes of my first book as well, True Tales from Another Mexico. I mean, the idea is that Mexicans are trying to break away from that. It's too limiting. It's too constraining. And in the first book, I did a lot of stories about how you could see this on the margins of Mexican society rather than at the center. The center was where it was kind of all kind of powerful and corrupt, and it didn't interest me very much. What I found more interesting was on the outskirts of the country, both figuratively and literally. And, you know, the people who have been breaking away longest from that have been immigrants. The people who said, you know, what's in my village is not, I'm not being given what I need, you know, and I'm going to search for something else. They don't know. They may not be able to articulate it fully, but certainly that's by their actions. That's exactly what they're doing, you know. And there is this feeling like I've got to get away. I've got to break away into the kind of some more a better deal for me. And they find it in the United States.
Which, in that sense, makes them very similar to a lot of other immigrant groups who have come over historically.
Yeah, except for that in this case, there's several differences. First of all, Mexico is geographically, you know, right next to the United States. Mexico is has been at peace, so it's a place you can go back to a lot. So even though they want to leave it, they also want to go back to it. It's a beautiful kind of idiosyncrasy, I think. I love that they love it, and then they hate it. They leave it. They want to go back to it. It treats them badly again. They want to go back to it again. It's a remarkable kind of thing of the human heart, which is another thing I find beautiful about the migration story. But Mexico has also been at peace. The dollars buy a lot. Its transportation costs have gotten even cheaper as time goes on, and so people can go back. Also, Mexican immigration is different because there's another slight difference in that from the migration from the rest of the world, and that is that Mexicans now are in every part of the United States. I mean, you find them in Anchorage, you find them in Atlanta, you find them in Tennessee and in Dallas, all over the country now, in the heartland, in the hinterland, in the big cities. And that really is the other thing that makes Mexican immigration kind of a different thing for this country, and one that I think we all need to know about. It's not just the people in New York who like got the waves of Italians or Russian Jews, or Boston or Chicago. It's now, you know, small towns in Georgia, small towns in Kansas, and small towns in Alaska too that are getting Mexican immigrants. It's really an essential issue and question for our country.
We're talking to Sam Quiñones. One of the there are many themes throughout your book, and there's the influence of immigrants on the United States and the influence of immigration on Mexico. And one of the things that I think a lot of Americans don't know about is the extent to which immigrants in the United States are organized and send money back, even for not only for their families, but for public works. And there's a story about that in Zacatecas, and putting their own candidates up for high offices or local offices in Mexico.
Right. That's been happening a little bit lately. I would not say that it's happening a lot one of the first case, I write about the first case where that was the most high-profile case of that happening. Obviously, Immigrant clubs are sending millions of dollars back for public works projects and some other things. The candidacies have become a little hit or miss, I think. The first one that I write about in the book was by a guy named Andres Bermudez, a gruff guy with a big beer belly, very much the ranchero, the typical immigrant ranchero, I would say, who was left his village in Zacatecas and crossed over illegally in the trunk of a car, went to Sacramento over the many years, became a very well-to-do rancher, and decided, hey, you know what? If I did it here, why can't I go back and show them how it's done back in my benighted little town where they threw me out of there because I was too poor? That's the way he conceived of it anyway. So he goes back and he runs for mayor of his town. He's known far and wide as the Tomato King because in Sacramento he's a big-time tomato farmer. In fact, most people in Mexico simply know him as the Tomato King because more than his real name. It becomes kind of his moniker as his whole campaign unfolds. And the story is really about his first campaign in which he wins, but then has it annulled because he's not a full-time, year-long resident of the town. Had not been a full-time resident of the town for a full year. So his whole the immigrants there were outraged because they were saying, "Hey, we're the ones who support these villages. We're the ones who support, even though we live up here in Anaheim or in Sacramento or someplace. We're the ones who are supporting these villages. Why would you take our money and not let us participate politically in the decisions of the country?" You know, and this is a very, very tender point for many immigrants, and I can entirely see their point. Because they do support those villages would be nothing were it not for the money these guys send back. But he's also, I focused on him also because he's this real, you know, I liked him because he was not Cesar Chavez or not Mahatma Gandhi, right? He was a kind of a typical guy, lots of foibles, you know, he essentially had a wife and two girlfriends, he drank tons of beer, very gruff guy, a real kind of human man, and not as kind of a saint or an apostle or anything like that. And this is why I focused on him, too, because he was such a human guy that he seemed to be just like everybody else, and that's why everybody voted for him, frankly. He was able to articulate both with his gruff voice and with his own persona the immigrant kind of immigrant feelings and desires and the wanting to show the folks back home, you know what, we went north, we were poor, we had nothing, we did it, you know, and we're going to come back and show you how it's done now. And that was very much, I think, that motivation is very much a part of the immigrant story. And he came back not out of any kind of altruistic motive. It was to show people, hey, you threw me out of here, I'm back to show you I can do it better than you can. A little bit of vengeance there as well. And now, 3 years later, he had his election, and all 3 years later, he won that same post and was serving as mayor. And then in the last election, he left that post, ran for Congress, and now he's a Mexican congressman and head of the immigration committee in the Congress. My story deals with his first campaign that I thought was the most emblematic of the immigrant's experience.
Well, and there's a lot of ironies with that too, which you point out, namely that somebody like this guy, the Tomato King, as he's called, goes to the United States, is very successful there, and in fact really isn't a very good politician and really doesn't know how to run the city in Mexico.
No, this is one of the great. I mean, it was difficult to point this out to immigrants. I mean, I thought that they were bringing up excellent points. We need to be heard politically if we're going to be supporting the country economically, and they do. Last year, $23 billion came from immigrants into Mexico. That's almost as much as Mexico gets from oil, and I think soon will be more than what Mexico gets from selling oil in the world market. So yes, it's an essential item nowadays for the Mexican economy. But, you know, there's also... they don't know their country that much anymore. They can't go home again as easily as they think they can because they do it all the time, but it's kind of a false sense that they get that I'm going home to Mexico, but what they're really going home to are these villages that only light up when they're back. And a lot of these villages are kind of like, have become kind of like tourist resorts for the people who left them as kids, say 15, 20-year-old kids went to the United States and 30 years later are still coming back and partying like crazy about a week every year, having wonderful time, and then they leave and they go back to the United States. It's kind of rest and relaxation, but they don't fully really understand what the Mexican reality. And I felt that the Tomato King, Andres Bermudez, was a little bit like that. He didn't really know his town that well, and even though it was hard to say that to immigrants, I think that eventually he really didn't. That's what I came to realize. It was too different for him. And I think what happened was he went back there to live, and now he does understand it better. I think that's what happened. He just learned it. But for many years, he'd only come back once a year a couple times a year, maybe a little bit for the fiesta and so on. And so there is this separation that academically, he had several academics who were on his side, who were making articulating these theories about why they did belong in Mexico, even though they lived in the United States. And the truth was, too, though, I mean, there was something truth to that, but I also felt that, gosh, they have been pretty separate now for a long, long time, and they see a totally different reality, and maybe it is, maybe they can't go home again. I don't know. It's a question.
We're talking to Sam Quiñones, and the book is Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream, and Sam Quiñones' website is samquiñones.com. You know, you made the comparison to petroleum dollars, and I think you make a very interesting point that the money coming in from the United States behaves in a similar way to the money that comes in through petroleum, and one of the effects it has is that it actually allows the Mexican government to stall on actually making any effective reforms that would create an atmosphere where people wouldn't want to leave.
Correct, and that's part of this idea that I try to enunciate through some of the stories that I read about, which is that immigration really doesn't stop immigration. On the contrary, immigration creates more immigration, and it does this by showing people what they can do in their poor villages. It does this also by simply exactly making, I believe, the leaders of Mexico kind of complacent. They get $23 billion a year nowadays. Now, it doesn't come to their coffers, but it does help sustaining large parts of the country that might be in serious crisis, and which they might be forced to address had they not had that money. Instead, what they have is the people who, by their very actions, show that they are most desirous of change. The folks who are voting with their feet are leaving, and so those voices are not in the country anymore. At the same time, they're sending money back, and that money kind of helps cushion the bad decisions, you might say, or the lack of decision that the policymakers and the Congress and the president and so on have not been able to take on. And really, I mean, you see this in lots of countries with oil dollars. I think that it's far more pronounced in those countries. Mexico is one of them, actually, where oil dollars come in, and the amount of money that comes in, it's not dependent on whether or not you've done a good job. It's not there's little accountability. It really breeds a lot of corruption. Mexican immigrant dollars are a tad different. I don't want to say it's exactly the same, but there is that sense that that money is going to be there, so we don't have to worry as much, and it's supporting big parts of the country, so those areas maybe don't really need the investment that maybe we might have to come up with some other way if it wasn't there, and on like this. And it kind of, I believe it definitely breeds a sense of complacency, and it's all a part of this problem that immigration from Mexico begets more immigration, and one of the ways it does is by forestalling change.
There's a number of stories in this book that we're not going to be able to get to talk about today just because of the limits of time, but there was one toward the end which really blew my mind, which was the story of drug running by traditional German Mennonites community of Mexico. That's not our image of Mexican drug kingpins.
It wasn't mine either. I was in Kansas doing a story about beef slaughterhouses, which is also in the book. And while I was there, and really those beef slaughterhouses are worked primarily by Mexican immigrants, this is why I was there. While I was there, though, I began to notice that there were lots of other illegal Mexican immigrants, except that they were Germans. And they were, fair-skinned and light, blonde hair, blue eyes, and they spoke German, and they were... from Chihuahua. And in Chihuahua, there's a large colony of German Mennonites. And these are called Old Colony Mennonites, in that they are the kind of Mennonites that kind of second cousins, you might say, to the Amish, and they're trying to remain kind of pious and holy and isolated from the sinful world and this kind of thing. They came down there in the 20s, and over a period of time, they become excellent, excellent dairy farmers, were nationally renowned for Mennonite cheese that they make. And they've been really a boon to that whole region, except for then in recent years, they've been under the same pressures that many other farmers in Mexico have been under. Unfavorable credit terms, drought, increasing prices for fertilizer and seed and so on, and a lack of arable land and a population that's growing. There's been three, in general, I would say there's been three responses among the old colony, the old world groups there, because they're now half in the modern world. They have one-room schoolhouses, and they have cars. So they used to have horse and buggies 20 years ago. Now they have cars. So they're kind of in between the old world and the new. There's three responses that they have given to this pressure. One has been to immigrate illegally to the United States, and they have passports to come through the United States on their way to Canada, because many of them still have Canadian passports even now. But a lot of them stayed. And so there is part of the illegal immigration flow into the United States from Mexico are German Mennonites, and you find them primarily in Texas, Oklahoma, and Kansas. But the other thing that's been happening is alcoholism has just ravaged that community. There's now 7 or 8 AA meetings, and there'd be more had the elders in the area not condemned it as a cult. For a long time, they condemned AA as a cult, and so many people didn't join it. I think there'd be probably double now that number if there were if there'd been like a willingness on the part of the leadership there to really embrace it. But it addresses the real serious problem that alcoholism has become, because as it's become a little bit more modern, the alcoholism is just insinuated itself into the community, and they haven't been able to drop it. The other two things that really people have done are taken to using drugs and smuggling drugs. And in fact, Mennonites from Chihuahua, according to the cop who's kind of the leading expert on the Mennonite mob, which is what his term for them, Mennonites from that area are the largest importers of marijuana to Canada, according to him. The largest, I know for a fact that the largest drug bust in Oklahoma was Mennonite cocaine and dope and weed from this part of, and I write about that in the book, from this part of Chihuahua. And so I went down there kind of trying to see if there was some story I could do with this, given this old world, new world theme of my book. I just wanted to see if there was some story I could do about a community in decomposition and a community trying to find its way to some solution to their problems. And the problem is, while I was down there, I made some rather large blunders, and I began to ask the wrong people, the wrong questions about the capos, the narco Mennonites, and so on. And the last day I was there, I experienced, it was a harrowing, harrowing experience, terrifying, that I was being followed literally by German Mennonites, old colony German Mennonites in Dodge Stratuses. There was two, in different points during the day, I was being followed for about 2 hours, this happened. By these guys who I thought were actually going to be killing me at some point. It was a very scary moment where I'm being followed through the countryside and then into the country, into the city of Cuauhtémoc, which is where they're near in Chihuahua. And I'm thinking of all these different ways that I saw in Starsky and Hutch. How did they avoid right. the cars? How did the Rockford Files and Mannix and all these shows I used to watch when I was a kid? I'm all alone. I don't have anybody to help me. And these guys are all very well connected. They know their town very, very, very well. And finally, I'm stopped at a stoplight, and another car is now following. This is a pickup truck. Guy pulls up next to me, sticks his head out the window, and he pulls out. If he had pulled out a gun, I'd be dead. But he pulls out a digital camera and begins taking my picture, very much wanting me to see his face and the fact that he's doing this, bam, 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 like that, taking his... And I freaked out at that point, drove to a Volkswagen dealership. They called the cops. The cops came, and eventually through a long kind of period of phone calls with Mexico City and Fox's press office and all this kind of thing, I got a ride with two cops, each with AK-47s on their lap, to the Chihuahua City Airport, and was able to leave. And I felt that was kind of my, that's the last story in the book, and it was my last story in Mexico. It was just this, after 10, you know, beautiful and oftentimes surreal years in Mexico, it was the most surreal moment of all to be chased out of the country by these guys, the German, old colony German Mennonites who have now taken to smuggling dope into the United States and Canada.
I mean, if it weren't so scary, it's sort of comical, because these are people who don't let their children play music or play sports or
right.
even run and yell. They're so very conservative,
right.
culturally conservative.
This, what you have is this old world flouting of religious dictates. That's what's happening in that community. It began with cars and rubber tires. The pastor said you're not to have rubber tires on your tractors. Well, pretty soon some got them, and then the rest got them, and pretty soon everyone's got them. Okay, well, we'll let that go. Okay, but now you can't have cars, or we're still sticking with the horse and buggy. Well, pretty soon people are buying cars. Then people wanted radios and television, and on it went. So flouting religious law is part of Mennonite culture. It's very clear. It happens all the time with many, many things, not just alcohol and drugs. Alcohol really began to be flouted because it could be done in silence. Sports and music is kind of something you'd hard to do silently, quietly. You're going to get a visit from the elders if you do it. But if you go out to the cornfield and get drunk, well, it's fine. And over a number of years, people began getting drunk a lot, and then after a while, they just took it out into the open. And a lot of the older people now complain about it. They say, oh, when I used to get drunk, I would go out to the cornfield. But that's the whole point. I mean, alcohol was prohibited back then, but they were still going out and getting drunk in the cornfield. Now it's just out in the open. And on Sundays, you can see this in the communities. On Sundays, there's kind of a version of Mennonite cruising, where that's when the one day the kids have off. And so after church, the kids go out and get royally wasted. And it is a dangerous place to be driving on those roads where drunk Mennonite guys driving up and down high on cocaine, drinking with a big bottle and the rum in their lap. I've seen this three times when I was there. They're kind of looking for, they're cruising up and down these county roads, and they now have cars that they don't really know how to drive that well. And so the scariest road in Chihuahua, this police chief told me, is the 20 miles between Cuauhtémoc and a town called Álvaro Obregón, which is where all the Mennonite colonies are located there. Because Mennonites still are really not very good drivers, and a lot of them are drunk or high. And so it's a scary, scary thing to drive along that road. You have to be very careful.
And it's, among other things, a cautionary tale about what happens when you put too many prohibitions on people.
Sure.
We've got just a moment or two left, and I wanted to go back to Delfino. The
right.
name of the book is Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream. We didn't get a chance to talk about the story of Antonio's Gun, with which you start the book, but people just have to buy the book and read it. But how did your writing of this book affect Delfino's life, if it did? I mean, he's on the cover of a
book. You know, he's down in Mexico now. He knows the book's out. I'm not sure if, I mean, it's just been out a week or two, so I don't actually know what the effect's going to be. We'll see. I think it's too early to tell. I just said, hey, man, you know, I'm thinking of, I gave him a copy of my first book, and he read that. And he stayed in my apartment a number of times when I was in the States. He stayed in my Mexico City apartment when I was in the States. So he knows what I do, and he's very clear on what I'm doing. We'll see. I don't know. It's a good question. I hadn't really thought of it because this is so recent. It's just beginning. The reaction's been great to the book, and so we'll see how it sells. But I don't know. We'll find out. He's back in Mexico. He found kind of a perfect fit for himself. I really think he's in a perfect place that he should not leave. Instead of being up in this rainy, muddy, very diseased village that he lived in Veracruz, he's now found work down in Cabo San Lucas as a construction worker. And so it's kind of the best of all possible worlds for him. It's in Mexico. His kid, his son Axel, and his wife Edith have moved out from Veracruz to be with him, and his brother, one of his brothers, has moved out too. At the same time, He's connected to the U.S. Cabo San Lucas is one of the highest priced parts of Mexico because of all the dollars that are down there. So he's got lots and lots of work, and so he's kind of like connected to the United States, but still still in Mexico, and he's working as a construction worker down there. And I think that, and it's also a very healthy place. I envision it anyway. I haven't been down to visit him yet, but I envision it as a place where there isn't like viruses that go through the town and kill 5 or 10 kids at a time, which is what would happen in Chocola. It's not cold and rainy, and the living isn't brutal the way it is up in his village in Veracruz. And I'm sure he's feeling that as well. So I think life is looking is smiling on Delfino right now, and hopefully with the book it will as well.
Sam Quiñones, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
It's really my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Sam Quiñones is a journalist with the Los Angeles Times, and he's the author of the book Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream, True Tales of Mexican Migration, published by UNM Press. Unfortunately, he's not going to be in Santa Fe, but he is in Albuquerque today, and from 1 to 3, he'll be at the University of New Mexico Student Union Building in a free event.
And at Bookworks.
That's right.
Tonight.
That's tonight. Okay. We're going to take a little break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR.
You're invited to join Forest Guardian's Stream Team and be part of the amazing transformation of the Santa Fe River. Plant native trees with friends and family and have fun in the sun on Forest Guardian's Santa Fe River Preserve, Saturday, April 14th, 10 a.m. till 3 p.m. Lunch, snacks, water, and tools provided. For details or to RSVP, visit fguardians.org or call 988-9126. Forest Guardians is a tax-exempt organization.
KSFR programming is underwritten by Locals Care. Locals Care community cards reward you for shopping and dining at over 100 locally owned businesses. You can support a Santa Fe nonprofit and earn rewards for yourself at any Locals Care business. Find program information and a current list of participating businesses and nonprofits at locals-care.com. Offered in cooperation with the Santa Fe Alliance and sponsored by Century Bank, Los Alamos National Bank, the New Mexican, and the City of Santa Fe. Iraq, Bosnia, Chechnya. How is your understanding of war shaped by the images you see? What are the ethical dilemmas faced by the photographers? Join College of Santa Fe's Documentary Studies Chair, Tony O'Brien, as he probes for answers with Time Magazine photo editor Mary Ann Golan and Magnum photographer Thomas Vorjak in a discussion on the dangerous art of capturing war on film, Saturday, April 14th at 7 p.m. in the Forum. This message is sponsored by the College of Santa Fe, a tax-exempt organization.
And in just the last couple of moments of our program, I'd like to welcome Geraldine Fiscus, and she's here to talk about the Yom HaShoah Holocaust Remembrance event at the Center for Contemporary Arts this coming Sunday at 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here. We thought that rather than just talking about the event, we would actually do a reading, which is just a little excerpt from one of the readings you're going to be doing at the event. What is the piece that you have before you now?
Well, it's a piece written by Ellie, a young girl. Well, she was 13 years old before she arrived in Auschwitz. And so this was written, of course, after the fact when she was... after she was liberated. But it's basically the point of view of a young girl, and she was with her mother. And so that whole situation is what this is about. And the part that I'd like to read is about the work commando. And it starts like this. When mother and I are picked up for the stone commando, she would order me to pass only the smaller stones, and the larger ones she would pass to the girl beyond me, skipping me. This would be dreadful. Mother would have to lean forward with a heavy rock, balancing it precariously, while the girl above me would have to lean down to receive it from her hand, causing additional burden to her. I would then insist on passing the large rocks, and Mother would angrily ignore me. This caused me so much hurt and anxiety that my dread of the stone commando turned into perpetual nightmare. But Mother would not yield. She did not understand that it is easier to bear the heavy stones than her indulgence at the expense of her effort and that of another woman. There are days when we manage to move a huge hill of rocks to the top of the mountain, and the following day we ordered to move it down again to the foot of the mountain with the same speed. One of the commandos is digging up graves in the nearby Krakow Cemetery. Work in this commando is easier because the large monuments afford shade and hiding places for occasional rest. To me, however, this is the most difficult work. Sometimes you dig up small bones and skulls, the bones of children, of infants. Despite lowered sensitivity, I am still pained by handling these bones. Despite a lack of contemplative powers, I think about the skeletons long after I am supposed to sleep. Once, I was picked for the cleaning commando, the favorite of commandos. It is a small commando in charge of cleaning the barracks of the Germans. We are given pails and washcloths and told to scrub the floors in about 50 barracks. At noon, we are given scraps from the meals of the German soldiers. This makes it a dream commando. But that day, it was Tisha B'Av, when the temple in Jerusalem was destroyed, and I was fasting. With tears of regret, I gave my lunch to another girl. This is my destiny. 2,000 years ago, the Romans picked the day when I was to taste real food to destroy the temple in Jerusalem.
Geraldine Fiscus, thank you so much for being with us very briefly. But the event is the Holocaust Remembrance Event at the Center for Contemporary Arts this coming Sunday, the 15th of April. It begins at 2 in the afternoon. There will be refreshments and much, much more. You can call the CCA also for more information. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams on the web at ksfr.org, and you can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. And now you can also hear this program any time of day at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features Artist of the Month, trumpet star Ingrid Jensen. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Hasta mañana. Ciao.